Welcome to Story Comic Presents, where we interview amazing storytellers and artists. This is episode 339. I'm your host, Barney Smith of StoryComic.com, and we're honored to have with us the founder of the Vermont College of Fine Arts, internationally acclaimed and best-selling author, Thomas Christopher Green.
Hey, Barney. Thanks for having me. And for your viewers who are watching this, I'm coming to you live in a rare personal appearance from a broom closet at my restaurant, Hugo's in Montpelier. I also own a restaurant, and this is the only private space I could find. So if it looks like I'm in captivity or something, I am okay. This is not a proof of life video. I'm actually doing fine.
Holding up today's newspaper.
Exactly. Yes, I am holding up today's newspaper. I'm not a hostage. I am actually safe and well.
So this is exciting. So as of this recording, Thomas, you just basically just came out with your ninth book? Did I get that correct?
My seventh. Before this, I had six novels, and this is my first book of, I would say, creative nonfiction. It's sort of a part memoir. Tiny True Stories is the subtitle of the book, but it's sort of a memoir in tiny stories, but also a kind of reminiscence of positive stories during my life during the pandemic.
And so this is basically, it's kind of like your COVID project in a way, because this was COVID inspired, this book.
It was. I mean, so this book came about a little accidentally. I've actually been writing a novel I'm still writing that I started during the pandemic and just takes me forever. And this was something I actually never intended to publish. When the pandemic hit, I was, I've always been an extroverted person. I own a restaurant. As you said, I was a college president for a long time. I was someone who was always out and about town. And I get my energy from other people and being around other people. And suddenly we were in quarantine. And, I saw my daughter and her mom, who live a block away, a couple hours a day. And otherwise, it was just me and my dog in my house. And one thing I've always told people is that the reason I write books is to tell stories to people who aren't in the same room as me. And so I began just telling sort of fact of life stories to people on social media as a way for me to feel less alone, but also connect with my friends and people I knew out and around the world. And the response to them was so positive, and some of the stories went viral, that I thought it made sense to compile them into a book. Now, this may be the only book, maybe someone else has done this, but that's been written with one finger on an iPhone. Because that's how I normally write on a laptop, but I literally would, every night I would write a different story.
Wow.
To my audience of people who follow me on social media out there, and I would type it into my phone, and they almost appear exactly like that. Now, we did do some editing and tightening and gave them titles and did other things, but most of these stories appear as they were originally written and during that time.
And it's 44 stories, I believe?
Yeah, I didn't actually know the count until someone in a review mentioned how much. Someone in the review counted them, but I guess there's 44 stories in here. Some of them are a little bit neighborhood slice of life from my life in Montpelier. Some of them are, reminiscence of my own life and significant things that have happened to me. Some of them are very funny. Some of them are sad. Some are poignant. But all of them, I think, have a kind of universal theme of, you know, how we pay attention to the world when life suddenly stops around us and how that matters.
Right. So was this almost in a way, was this kind of like your therapy in a way, as you mentioned before, that you're an extroverted person by nature and you needed to kind of do this for yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it was for me and part of it was for other people. There's something, you deal with a lot of storytellers and you talk to people about storytelling. Storytelling is kind of first and foremost how I consider myself. You know, people define me as a novelist, but, storytelling for me is a contractual relationship on some level between a storyteller and a listener. And so these were stories I told that both helped me, but I think I could see the effect it was having on other people, because I think everybody was struggling during that time. And I think we still haven't realized kind of the collective PTSD we probably all have from that period of time, because it was so unique and unusual. And this disease was so new and no one knew how you could even get it and what it meant. And even seeing other people was terrifying in a way. And so reminding people of the kind of small connections that make up the social fabric in which we all live was a critical part of this project. And yes, that helped me, but I think it also helped other people along the way.
How was this how was this process, as you mentioned that one thing, but just from the inspiration piece, how was this process different than your fiction works?
Well, I mean, writing a novel is a big bear of a thing. I mean, it takes me, some people can do it faster. It takes me several years to write a novel. There's an incredible amount of architecture to a novel, to how you conceive about, it's almost like shipbuilding, but you don't actually know what kind of ship you're going to build until you're halfway done. And so right. There's a process of sort of creating the scaffolding and the other pieces to make it work in a novel that aren't true with sort of these short stories. Now, what I did here in some ways was actually, you know, stumble onto a mode of storytelling I didn't know I had or existed. And part of that actually came from writing it on the iPhone, that there's an intimacy to these stories that is, you know, has kind of a sit down and listen to me, I'm about to tell you something kind of thing. And there's an economy of language that I think is different than novel writing. You know, novels, you move from scene to exposition to scene, you know, chapters, sentences, all these kinds of things. In this, it's almost an immediacy kind of storytelling, like you and I are sitting down at a table having a drink together, and I'm going to tell you this great story that happened from my past or something that happened to me earlier in the day. And some of the events in here are significant, and some of them are not. You know, they say that a good Irishman should be able to get a good story out of a trip to the post office. And I think a lot of these stories have that kind of character.
Thomas, you said that you'd take a long time to write, but looking at your bibliography, Mirror Lake was in 2003, After the Rain was 2004, I'll Never Be Gone 2005. You were writing a book a year at one point.
Yeah, well, it looks that way. There's an optical illusion to this because, you know, when you finish a book, sometimes it's 2 years before it's published. So, right. I was publishing a book every 2 years, and then I started Vermont College of Fine Arts, which in some ways was my fourth novel. And so there was a 7-year lag between starting the college and then publishing The Headmaster's Wife, which was the one book of mine that became an international bestseller and the one most people associate with me. And then I published, and again, 2 years later, I published If I Forget You and then The Perfect Liar. So yeah, there's an illusion of prolificness that I'm not sure is true, but and then it's been a chunk of time until this book. So, but yeah, 7 books I feel good about. You know, I love them all. You know, right. 7 books. I'm one of 7 children. I have 7 books. It feels kind of healthy.
Do you feel as though writing this nonfiction piece of short stories has changed your writing style at all for when you're going as you're writing this fiction, your new fiction book?
I think that I'm still not entirely sure. I think maybe it has. You know, I mean, I've always been really interested in the economy of language. You know, when you hear good oral storytellers, what differentiates people who tell stories well orally from other people who don't tell stories that well is how quickly they bring you into the important things you need to know, take you through them, and then surprise you, right? I mean, that's what great storytelling ultimately is. And so in this book, I think I do that over and over again. And taking that and applying it to novels is a tricky thing, but there is a usefulness to that idea of reminding yourself that the economy of storytelling is really critical to good writing.
And so talk to us a little bit about how you got connected to Rootstock through this, because as I say, you're not a first time author.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've published mostly in New York. I've been with Simon & Schuster. I've been with HarperCollins. I've been with St. Martin's Press. So big, 6 publishers. And then I've been published into, you know, 13 different languages. So I've been published in other countries. And so I've kind of done the big publishing thing my whole life, and I'll do it again. This is a book that is different, that I didn't think mainstream publishing would fully understand. I thought if they ever did, it would sell millions of copies because I think it really resonates with people and the reviews are such that it's deeply resonating with people. But I felt like it needed a different approach. And I felt like in Montpelier, coming out of the flood, the other things we were going through, that would also be a chance to support a Vermont publisher. Sam Kolber, the publisher of Rootstock Publishing in Montpelier used to work for me at the college, and so someone I know.
Okay.
And she was an editor at our literary magazine that we house there. So Sam and I have a history and knew each other. I knew she liked these stories. And I also wanted a beautiful book. And by beautiful book, I don't mean, you know, a book like my words. I meant actually physically a beautiful book for this book. It was important to me. And that's something that New York Publishing has kind of forgotten how to do for the most part. I've just seen in my own time, since when Mirror Lake was published in 2003 to Perfect Liar published in 2019, the quality of the paper is less, the design aesthetics are less important. And I think they really put together a beautiful book, and having some control over that process was important to me. So I decided to keep it local for this book, and I'm happy I did.
So if for folks that are out there that thinking like, you know, Thomas, I did a COVID project, and what do I do with this? I mean, what is some advice would you give to first-time authors?
Well, that's always a hard question to answer. I mean, first-time authors, I always say, you know, write the best book you can. Don't think about the audience. Do the thing that's most important to you. And then usually I tell people, try to find an agent, you know, which is how most books are sold. I happen to have two agents. I didn't use an agent for this book because it was a local book. But publishing has changed a lot. You know, Rootstock Publishing is actually a hybrid publisher, which is, you know, the author covers some of the costs. It's not self-publishing. The author covers some of the costs. The publisher covers the rest of the costs. The royalties are higher than a traditional arrangement you have in New York. In my case, they actually published me traditionally because I had that track record, and people would probably buy this book, but they're a hybrid publisher. I think there are all these new models that are evolving. So write the best book you can, and then try to see what kind of market you can find for it.
Right. I mean, that's a good point, because you've been involved in the arts for decades right now. So where do you see that accessibility? Do you see that artists and authors have more access to getting their work out there now?
You know, it's actually a double-edged sword. I think there are... Right. I think it's an evolving marketplace where you have these hybrid publishers and other things that do provide access that wasn't there years ago. At the same time, your big six publishers, you know, which used to be the big 10 and used to be the big 15 and the big 20, you know, there's been massive consolidation in the publishing marketplace, and they are taking less and less risks. And so it is harder and harder for new writers to break through. You know, it's definitely a more challenging market for agents to sell books to publishers. You know, kind of mirroring what's happening in America, frankly. I mean, you're seeing a small proportion of authors who are getting wealthier and wealthier, and there's less gambles on literary fiction or fiction that they're not sure is going to reach a large marketplace. Not that they're very good arbiters of that, by the way, because historically they've made a lot of mistakes on that, and they make guesses that they think are going to work, and then the books don't sell. So it's or a book they think is never going to sell, you know, blows everybody's mind and sells a ton of books because people really care about what's being said.
No, it's Notes from the Porch. Is this kind of also, have you gotten a flavor now of wanting to do more nonfiction or put together a memoir? Because you got a great story on yourself then, Thomas. Or is this considered almost like your memoir or autobiography in a way?
Well, I could see doing this again. I think this book is going to have long legs, as they say in publishing. I think it's a book that's going to reach a large audience over time. It's a harder thing to do because it's emanating from a small publisher, so you don't have that great marketing force and will behind it that I've seen with other books where I'm getting, you know, People Magazine reviews and stuff that drive book sales. But I could see doing this again. I could see writing a memoir. You know, I like, you know, telling stories. And that's what I've always done. And some of these are stories I used to tell, you know, as graduation speeches at the college. You know, I always did unconventional graduation speeches where I could work without notes and I would just tell a story that I thought I could sort of spin and make relevant to people, but I wanted to entertain people in that environment too. And so, you know, this idea of, you know, reducing the space between the storyteller and the story listener, which I think these stories do, is very intriguing to me.
Literally the entire world went through COVID. So
right.
Who would you say would be the audience would be for this?
You know, I think the amazing thing about this book is there's 44 stories. Some are a paragraph long, some are 4 or 5 pages long. I think you can pick this book up And you can open it anywhere, and you can read something that's going to make you laugh, make you smile, might make you cry. That's going to resonate with who you are as a human being. So I think, again, this is a book that's going to receive a very large audience because people are responding so strongly to it. And it's also an antidote to, in some ways, the times we're living in. I mean, we're living in perilous, dark times. The news is a relentless barrage of sadness and death and people dying and people in challenging circumstances. Our political system and what's happening there. So this is pure escapism. This is read this book, forget about the world for a minute, and remind ourselves of kind of the fundamental goodness that most people actually possess, in that there are small moments of joy that comes in the most unexpected ways. And that's what Notes from the Porch, Tiny True Stories to Make You Feel Better About the World actually does.
If people want to pick up this book and read it, where is the best place they could go to and find this book then?
Well, I always tell people to go to your local independent bookstores because, they're the backbone of a community. I've always said this, that, I think the measure of a healthy community is whether or not they can support an independent bookstore. And in Montpelier here, if you can support an independent bookstore through a flood and then back again, like we did with Bear Pond Books, that makes me really highly in Montpelier. So I always encourage independent bookstores, but some people read on Kindle. It's available on Amazon on Kindle. It's available on Amazon as a book. Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold, you can get it. If they don't have it, they can order it for you.
And also go to your local library and request your library to carry it as well.
Absolutely. Some of the local libraries may already have it. If they don't, then request them to carry it, and I'm sure they'd be happy to do that.
If people want to learn more about you and your work, where's the best place that they could go to find you online then?
Oh, they can follow me on Facebook at Thomas Christopher Green. There's actually two Thomas Christopher Green pages. One is like a page that was set up by a publisher years ago I never use. If the photos on it look like I am 25, that's not the one to follow. But the other one, please follow it. I'm at my friend limit, but you can follow me there. Also Instagram at Thomas Christopher Green. Green has an E at the end. You can write me there, interact with me, follow some of my stories there, get a glimpse into my life. And I'll do the same for you.
When your next book comes out, you got to come back on and we can talk about it.
Yeah, I'd love to do that, Barney. I really appreciate you doing this. I mean, and I think the work you're doing is really important here, paying attention to artists and writers and getting their stories out too. So it's I'm grateful to you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Any final thoughts?
No, I think we're having an early spring here in Vermont, and I hope anybody listening right now is surviving mud season. And as someone who now lives in town, and for years I used to live in Calais, and I was always jealous of the people who lived in town during mud season because they had no idea of the individual horrors that were happening at any given hour out on these back roads, just 5 miles.
Away.
Like, oh, it's a beautiful sunny day. And meanwhile, it just feels like you're fighting for your life just to go get groceries. So my sympathies with all the Vermonters who are out there in the woods and listening to this, and may your roads dry up soon.
Especially when you're driving and it's like, you get that rep, like, this is where I'm driving, I guess.
Oh,
I can't get
out
of this.
It's better now because our cars are higher. I used to have like these old low Saab 900s back in the 90s, and
right, yeah,
bottomed them out so badly, it was terrible.
Awesome. All right, well, thank you so much, Thomas.
Yeah, my pleasure, Barney. Good to talk with you. So before we get to that, how do people listen to you? Do they hear you on podcasts? Do they see this video? What do they do? Is it both?
Both. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I get a lot. I've said that the podcasts have got about 20,000 downloads. It's usually great for, people driving. They like to listen to it.
Yep.
But I also have the video version of it on my YouTube page as well for folks that just want to see the conversation. So,
yep. Yeah. Cool. Very cool.
And once it's all edited and whatnot, I'll send you the link to it. So I'll probably work on it over the weekend. So, all right. All right. Here is the intro.